This is Texas Matters. From Texas Public Radio, I'm David Martin Davies. The night of December 6, 1991, four girls, ages 17, 17, 15, and 13, were working and hanging out at a I Can't Believe It's Yogurt store in Austin. Someone or someones came into that shop and committed a horrible crime. Eliza Thomas, Amy Ayers, and sisters Jennifer and Sarah Harbison were forced to strip. They were tied up. They were murdered. The shop was set on fire, and the case is unsolved. 25 years after that night, it is still a deep, dark mystery. Who Killed These Girls? Cold Case, The Yogurt Shop Murders is a new book that explores in rich detail the murders and the flawed prosecutions of four suspects. The author is crime writer Beverly Lowry.
I didn't live in Austin when the murders were committed in 1991, but my son did. And I visited Austin pretty often, and through the early 2000s. And it seemed every time I came here to Austin to visit, something new had taken place in the whole case of the yogurt shop murders. And so I knew about them from my son and his family and from newspaper reports. And about 2002, I guess, I asked my son if the yogurt shop murders were ever going to be out of our lives. This was after some new incidents. And he said, no, they're with us forever. And that kind of hooked my attention even more strongly and my obsession.
So it became an obsession for you. So you were able to tell through your son that this was a horrible crime that changed Austin itself.
Yes. And anybody who lived here at the time thought the same thing. It was a city that was less than half the size it is now. And it was still known as Slackerville, you know, as Hippieville, and had that reputation, and it was a safe city for as compared to other cities of its size and population.
So there was this shedding of innocence. Yes. At the time. When you started penetrating, you said, I'm going to take a look at this case. Of course, you are a very accomplished crime writer, and you know how to do these things. And you started looking at it. Did you have this expectation that you would find the clue that would finally solve it?
I never thought that. I never thought I'm the one who can solve this. It wasn't like a search for the killer. I mean, obviously, it would have been a wonderful thing for everybody if I'd been able to do that. But it wasn't what I was focused on or what I was moving toward. What I wanted to do was try to understand how this could have happened, that this terrible, horrific crime had occurred. And at that point, some 15 years later, 16 years later, nobody was in prison for having committed the murders. And so what the first thing I did, without saying anything to anybody concerned with the case or concerned with my publication history, was to go and read the trial transcripts of the two men who were, in 1999, arrested or indicted for the murders.
And did you, so you read the transcripts, I guess. Mm-hmm. That's for Robert Springsteen and,
yes,
and for, was that Michael James Scott?
Right.
And so what did you find?
Well, I had done this before for my book Crossed Over. I had read trial transcripts, and in a capital case, which these were, the testimony in the trial go on for a very long time. And so there are many, many details. There are many really moving testimonies. Plus, you find out where somebody was at, say, 10:03, where they were at 10:04. So there's a lot of information there. and I combed them. The transcripts at that time were in the basement of the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. And so I would go down there, take my laptop, and make notes and think and make more notes and think more. I saw the photocopies of the crime scene photographs, and they were as gruesome and as terrible as you can imagine and more. And so I was little by little coming closer to thinking I might write about this. And then I went, there was a hearing in 2006 that I went to, open to the public. And so there I saw some of the players, lawyer, prosecutor, judge, defendant. And that was it. I thought, I'm writing this, I'm doing this. And the other thing is, I've had such empathy for the parents of the murdered girls, the four girls. My younger son was killed in a hit-and-run incident, and I never found out who hit him, if they knew who they were. So I have a sense of what that uncertainty is like. And that was probably the chief thing that propelled me forward and to think, I'm going to do this.
As you have found out, and the city of Austin found out, you cannot begin to learn and explore this case. It's so horrific, and not be changed by it.
That's right. And changed in many ways. And, you know, you can't write any book, fiction or nonfiction, without teaching yourself, without learning. But in nonfiction, you tend to do enough research to learn in areas you never thought you would go, whether it's looking at these terrible crime photos, listening to interrogation tapes, looking at Supreme Court decisions, all of those things enlarge your perspective and your bank of knowledge. They just teach you. And so, of course, this one in particular, because once I started doing interviews, then, you know, I met people and talked to them, and they had certain points of view, and my job, I thought, was to understand their point of view, whether or not I agreed with it.
So the case had this huge twist. After 8 years after the murders, there were arrest of these four individuals, these four men, and everyone in Austin thought this had been cracked, this case had been solved, and it didn't work out that way. And now they're not in prison anymore. The two that went to jail are out.
Right.
Two were not brought to trial. So people are wondering if these guys got away with this horrific murder. And of course, there is this DNA evidence, particularly from the sexual assault, that we know does not point towards any one of these four.
Right. It actually excludes them. And it also excludes every person who, there were almost 50 confessions, most of them, you know, wild-eyed, I did it, put me in jail, kind of the kind of thing that happens after a high-profile crime like this. But they tested everybody who came in and out of the yogurt shop that night, and everybody who confessed or said they knew who had done it, and have not found anyone whose DNA matches what they found inside the girls.
And what about a national database search?
Well, the DNA test that came up with the fullest information were done in 2008, 2009. Those were what are called YSTR, Y-STR DNA tests. And it separates out the Y, or the male chromosome, from the rest of the DNA and gives a more specific profile of that DNA, of a male DNA, but there is no YSTR database at this point. And so, no, there isn't one. There's a DNA database, but there's not a YSTR, and it would have to be that in order to come up with the specific results that came up at that time in 2008.
Did they ever do a one-to-one test to see if it matches with the DNA of Paul Dennis Reed, the fast food killer?
Yeah, I mean, they did it with people, anybody they could come up with. But the FBI behavioral profilers said after they went over this case in detail that it didn't match any other crime in their database. Now, this is not about DNA. It's just about behavioral profile. And that basically the Austin Police Department was on its own, that they couldn't contribute a lot. They did come up with a profile, but it was really based on speculation, just like pretty much everything else.
What is this yogurt shop murder? What does it tell us today, 25 years after this? The case.
It tells us several things, but I'll just hit some high points. It tells us that this kind of thing can happen. And, you know, there are unsolved murders throughout history. And, you know, JonBenet Ramsey, to name one, that's happened more recently, but the Black Dahlia. And there are ripperologists all over the world figuring out who Jack the Ripper was. So it's not as though this never happens and that a crime this spectacular and this carefully detailed, looked into and investigated by the police department and the FBI and the ATF, that it could remain unsolved. It's that this is how things go sometimes. We don't always get the answers we think we deserve, and we certainly think the families of those girls and the girls deserve. They deserve answers. Of course they do. But answers aren't always just out there. You know, I think anybody who grows up past 10 years old knows that. And also, I really think that the section on the interrogations and confessions of Robert Springsteen and Michael Scott teach us how false confessions can occur and how easy it is to understand once you really look at an interrogation like that, that you people always say, I would never confess to anything I didn't do. After you read enough of these, and these aren't the only ones I've read, you come to believe what the original case agent on this case said, which John Jones, which was you put yourself into a 6x6 room without windows and with two cops going at you. You don't know what you'd do, and I believe that's true. And I think all of that and how the law changed to affect these the legal cases is fascinating to me, and I would hope it would be to readers.
They literally put a gun to the head of Michael Scott.
Right. He is under interrogation, and he keeps saying things like, I don't think I was there, guys. I don't think I was there. And so one policeman came in and put a gun to the back of Mike Scott's head to say, this is how it felt to be one of those girls in the yogurt shop that night. How does this make you feel? In order to scare him into saying something he might not otherwise have said. And the police themselves acknowledge, the policeman who held the gun actually on the stand said, we thought it might scare him into saying something he otherwise wouldn't have. It had the opposite effect. It shut him down. But the picture, the clip from the videotape of the interrogations became public and caused quite a stir in Austin in the media.
Overall, Do you think that the police, were there blunders? Did they miss stuff?
You know, I think there were, yes, there were some mistakes. I would call them mistakes because what I believe is every policeman who worked on this case worked his or her heart out. And I believe that to my soul. They wanted to solve this case more than anything. There was no CSI unit in Austin at that time. And CSI, I mean, the first murder that was solved through DNA collection happened in England in 1988. So you're talking only 3 years beyond the understanding that science could help solve a crime, could possibly. So it's not that unusual, and the Austin Police Department shouldn't come into heavy criticism because maybe they didn't collect all the data that could have been collected. The big mistakes were, for instance, how the place was torched after the murders were committed, and the origin of the fire became a very important issue. The steel shelves that had melted and the aluminum ladder, the top two steps of which had it melted away, they were gone, were lost. They were put out. There's a photograph of them sitting out in the alley behind the yogurt shop the next day. And that would have provided those two items alone, and there were others, would have provided essential detail about how the fire started and how it then ran across the room. And nobody knows what happened to them. So was that a blunder? You could call it a blunder, yes. But I think, as several people said, they did the best they could with what they had. And I believe that to be true.
Beverly Lowry is the author of Who Killed These Girls? Cold Case, The Yogurt Shop Murders. It's published by Knopf.